Welcome to Politics Done Right. I am your host, Egberto Willis. This is a progressive program that will take the mystery out of politics. This is the program that will encourage you to make sure government becomes we the people. Whether you are liberal, progressive, conservative, or otherwise, you get to hear your point of view. We are an independent media outlet that, unlike mainstream media beholden to corporations, we only owe allegiance to you. Remember, you can also send me a tweet at EGBERTOWILLIES. That is at Egberto Willis. Let us engage. It is Politics Done Right. Welcome to Politics Done Right. From the studios of KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, your community radio station, we have a great program for you today. Marion Burgess assumed the office of Harris County District Clerk recently. She immediately saw a problem. The jury pool did not reflect the county, so she established Stand for Justice to make it do just that. Michael Levitin, who is a professor and author and one of the participants in Occupy Wall Street. Now we discuss the 10th year anniversary as he's written a book that described it in detail. Tiffany Cross has a message for the MAGA treason rally, but it goes much deeper than that. And of course, we have a Democratic strategist on that gives a message that says, look, this is where we really are at. This is where we should be looking. This is what we've got to do. We've got to lean in. Folks, check this out. We have a great show for you today. Do remember, we are in Fund Drive right now, but you are still getting yourself a great program that we work at putting together for you. Stuff that you, some that you may know on a small level, some that you may not know at all. That's why we are here. Politics Done Right, KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. We're asking you to invest in this community radio station. But why? Because, folks, there's a lot of media out there, but it's not media that you control. It's not media that has your interests at hand. When we're talking about community radio, when we're talking about this community radio station, KPFT 90.1 FM, we are talking about a station that is solely funded by whom? You. And if it is funded by you, our loyalty is to you. Most other stations, commercial stations, they're funded by their advertisers, and their advertiser needs to program you. And they need to have you in a particular modal. That is why our politics is so bad. Because we need you uninformed. Politics Done Right doesn't believe in that. Politics Done Right, KPFT 90.1 FM, Pacifica Network, we don't believe that. We believe that it is essential that you are in control. It is essential that you support us so that we can feed the ethos, that we can give, we can enlighten with what is the absolute truth. In that light, I'm asking you to please call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org and support us. You can support us with a $25 membership, a $40 membership, or you can get any one of our gifts that you find there. Please do this in the name of Politics Done Right. Also, remember that you can get one of my several books out there. As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, for a contribution of $120. It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors, for a contribution of $120. How to Make America Utopia, Take Away the Economy from Those Who Rigged It. A pledge of $120. You can get any two of those books for $200. Any three of those books for $250. That is to support our station. And all those books, I promise you, give you all that you need to have that conversation across the board to ensure, to help us make a better America. So please support us. Please support KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Call 713-526-5738 or visit kpft.org. In the name of Politics Done Right, please select one of our books, several of our books, or one of our offers. We're here for you. You can get Politics Done Right Mondays through Fridays on Facebook Live at facebook.com/politicsdoneright, on YouTube Live at politicsdoneright.com/YouTube. Please do not forget to follow me on Twitter for updates. My handle is at Egberto Willis, at EGBERTOWILLIES. Before you get started, please remember to keep your community radio station in your minds, KPFT in your minds. Talk about it. Tell your friends about it. Tell them you know about this station in town, 90.1 FM Houston, that needs your support, that is there to provide what that nourishment that we need. 713-526-5738. KPFT.org. Visit us online. Contribute online. KPFT 90.1 FM. You can visit us at kpft.org. Please, folks, go get your vaccine. All those people on the radio that are talking to you and telling you, you don't need to, you want your freedom, you want all that kind of stuff. They're lying to you. Remember, all the people at Fox News are vaccinated. They can't go to work unless they're vaccinated. All those folks that are giving all these different communities bad information, they are vaccinated, and the ones that are dying are not. Do not become a casualty of this bad information. They are using you as a prop. Get vaccinated. You know, I watch all the Sunday news shows to figure out what is really the most important things that we need to be talking about. And most of the times it turns out that we don't get much. But today there was one particular statement that was made by Maria Teresa Kumar. She is a not only a pundit, but she does a whole lot in the Democratic Party. And I want you to listen to this, and then we'll take it on the other side.
But I do think that immigration, voting rights, abortion are what Democrats are going to run on in 2022, not what their spending bill is.
But I do think that this is where the Biden administration, I think, really needs to wrap themselves around, and the Democrats need to wrap themselves around and learn a little bit from the recall, in the Newsom recall. And that is, yes, right now, Biden may have had a tough week, but it is an asymmetrical conversation between him and what Trump represents. Mm-hmm. Talk about the abortion bill. Talk about Larry Elder's in his totality. It's the antithesis of American values. And that's where they need to lie about, because we right now are talking about policy, but we are right now really living in a cultural war of what is the heart of America. And that is where the Biden administration really needs to lean into.
What you're saying?
She's absolutely right. What we are in is a cultural war. And speaking policy does not speak to that cultural war, but speaking to that cultural war actually speaks to policy. In other words, and that is why what she's saying is so important. If we go into this debate talking about policy and policy and policy, and we allow the right to frame an immoral ideology into a form that appeals to many on the right and otherwise, they will win because they know how to do it. We know how to do it as well. But what we have to do is frame it on a values basis. And after framing on a value basis, understand that out of those values come the policies that America say they want. If you value life, you value healthcare. If you value life, you value a vaccine. If you value vaccines, you value the implicitly all of humanity. And we can go from policy to policy to policy in the form of values, in the form of what they're doing. As she says, it's the antithesis to what we are all about. Maria Teresa Kumar. Perfect statement in a few lines. for the Democratic Party, and I hope they heed that message. Tiffany Cross, host of the Cross Connection, with a recipe of sarcasm, reality, truth, and objective thought. She puts out a piece that I think everybody needs to hear about these insurrectionists that are back in DC. And by the way, it's just a small number of them now that decided to take the chance to come. She put a hell of a perspective onto these people who would have many believe that these are the persecuted ones. I want you to listen to Tiffany. She hits the nail on the head. Very few will miss what she says, both with sarcasm, objectivity, and truth. Check this out.
I really don't know how to capture the current state of affairs in the United States. I'm here in the nation's capital, and just outside, there are sporadic gatherings of white supremacists and MAGA members protesting democracy. And all across these divided states, there are at least 75 million people who voted for the MAGA ruler to continue to lead this country down a path of degradation. Honestly, the best I can say right now is we tried to tell you. Let me try and paint the picture for the many who may not understand this collective frustration we're all feeling right now. Do you guys remember that time that thousands of black and brown people were just outright fed up with centuries of brutality and outraged at seeing black bodies fall in the street at the hands of state-sanctioned violence with very little consequence? And then we all got so mad about all the voter suppression and stormed the Capitol in a failed attempt to undo the will of the people? Yeah, I don't remember that ever happening either. So as we watch this brutal and beautiful American experiment unravel, we weep at the destruction of what we built for free. And ironically, we fight the hardest to save her. It's a good time to remind the people that Frankenstein was the doctor, not the monster, as my friend Michael Eric Dyson says. And now the Frankenstein, that is the extreme right, has created the monster of white supremacy, which is now cannibalizing. We all suffer because of them. From the folks who mistake masks for persecution, to the folks who deserve prosecution, and even the marchers today hailing those hundreds of violent insurrectionists as heroes and martyrs. It's interesting how we view patriotism in this country. After America's history with my lineage, it's baffling who the bigger patriots are right now. President John F. Kennedy posed the question, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Well, the great defender of democracy, Latosha Brown, makes the valid point that that's a great question to ask from a place of privilege, when your needs are met, when your family has wealth, when you're not under the constant threat of having the ground drop from under you. But when has that ever been the collective story for people of color in this country? So as indifferent policymakers cut off benefits, continue their long ongoing efforts to obliterate voting rights in this country, deny women their liberty, and the courts allow millions to be kicked out of their homes, and we're all getting crushed under this flawed system. I've got to wonder, when I see the right wing protesting, what exactly do you have the temerity to be mad about? When you've never known actual persecution, it's amazing the narratives you can tell yourselves. Like somehow injustice is attacking the United States Capitol and admitting it in open court and still being granted permission to vacation in Mexico. That's Jenny Cudd's sad story of injustice. While men like Julius Jones sits in a prison on death row after receiving an unjust, racially biased trial in a murder case. And for many of you, that's justice. So, yeah, have your poorly attended rallies, always loud and proud when you're not outnumbered. Congratulations, you've somehow managed to normalize the bizarro world, and you've bridged the gap between openly treasonous and elected officials. But just know, we're all so glad that this is finally the series finale of this stale routine, because we have seen and survived this act before, and we will again.
Orchestrated rage against not those who deserve your rage, but those who told you to have rage against. It's amazing. I love the way she said it. The elected official meeting the treasonous, because after all, it is the elected official, the ones on the right, creating those who are now effecting treason on this country on a false pretext. But as Tiffany said, we've been here before. Others have constantly used the others as scapegoats when they wanted to extract more and more. We've survived it before, and we will survive it again. So it doesn't matter what you guys are doing in DC protesting. You're the weak ones. The ones that we are after are the ones who are trying to take permanent power, something that we won't let happen. Harris County, Texas is likely the most diverse county in the country, if not the most diverse county in the country. However, its jury system doesn't look like the county. And what that means is, in this era where we must put much interest into our justice system of all forms, we have to ask the question, why? Is it because of certain structures? Is it because it's being a jury is made too difficult? What is the reason? Well, this election cycle brought Marilyn Burgess as the Harris County District Clerk, and she saw the problem. Recently, she made quite a few changes within the system and went to the courts to get some assistance in ensuring that she could mitigate these problems, finding out what the issues were, and started a campaign known as the Stand for Justice campaign. And it's over the radio stations, in social media, etc. She recently released a press release that said, "Jury service conditions in Harris County are improving significantly under the leadership of District Clerk Marilyn Burgess, as Commissioner's Court passed Tuesday a proposal that will provide coffee, meal vouchers, and free parking to jurors. District Clerk Burgess is confident these measures will make the jury service experience more enjoyable, fulfilling one of her administration's principal goals." That's a very important thing to do, isn't it? Because if you can't park, if you can't get vouchers, etc., people of little means will likely not be able to serve on justice. Take a look at what one of her one of the promotions that she's doing to try to talk to people about the changes that's occurring in the county to ensure that we have a more diverse jury system.
Harris County needs your help. Over the past 5 years, our county's jury appearance rate has hovered around a disappointing 20%. Some areas in our county are as low as 10%. Lower appearance rates tend to correlate with less diverse panels, and less diverse panels disenfranchises many involved in the legal process. If you are accused of a crime or unjustly sued, would you rather have a jury that looks like something from our past, or one that's more representative and looks more like Harris County's present diverse population?
I am Marilyn Burgess, Harris County's District Clerk. If you receive a jury summons from my office, please answer your call to serve. We need your voice at the table. You could make the difference in a more just outcome.
These types of outreach make a difference. And it is good that right now in Harris County, there is somebody, there is a leader that's actually doing that. So let's go ahead and talk to her. Marilyn Burgess is the Harris County District Clerk. She is a CPA and former chief financial officer for a local company. She was also executive director of the PTA. It is there that Ms. Burgess confirmed her calling as an advocate for causes that improve the lives of working and middle-class families, single mothers, and teachers. She subsequently served in other executive positions in various organizations. She is using her expertise now and her position as the Harris County District Clerk to bring fairness to our jury system by enhancing awareness and much, much more. Ms. Burgess, welcome to Politics Done Right, the head of our County District Clerk. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, Alberto. Great to be with you.
Look, first of all, I understand that when you got your position, there's one thing that you notice about how voting was occurring, I mean, not voting, how our jury system was actually functioning. It wasn't representative of the community. Tell us, first of all, what did you see when you came into the county?
Well, when I first came into office, improving the juror experience, increasing appearance rates, increasing diversity of those that appear was a top priority of my office. And my office has been working on it diligently ever since January of 2019. I feel like we're finally making a little progress in that regard. Harris County being one of the most diverse counties in the nation, our juries need to reflect that diversity, and currently they do not. And so we have launched numerous measures to try to increase appearance rate, but particularly to target minority communities that are underrepresented in the numbers that appear currently.
Now, I think you appeared in front of the commissioner's court recently. There are a lot of things that you think can actually make it more appealing for those for other people to join the PM, because there are some real reasons why some people are not predisposed to serve on the jury. First of all, what are those reasons as you see it?
Well, in my opinion, the number one thing that keeps people from showing up to appear for jury duty is that there are a lot of people who are living paycheck to paycheck, and they don't have the benefit of being paid if they aren't at work. If they go to jury duty instead of going to work, they're not going to get paid for that day. And they simply cannot afford to show up. And so that's what we went to Commissioner's Court for initially, was to ask for a pay increase so that we could pay jurors enough that they could afford to miss that day of work and be there. And to me, that's the number one thing that's going to make an impact of getting the diversity that we need on our jurors. They were reluctant to implement anything in the middle of the pandemic because they didn't think we could track the kind of impact it had. We wouldn't know if people were showing up because the pandemic was lessening or if it was because of the pay. So they've committed to revisiting this when we get back to normal operations. But in the meantime, they agreed to put forward some benefits for jurors to make their experience a little bit more pleasant and to recognize that they're giving of their time and we appreciate them. So what we were able to get them to do was to provide free coffee for the first time in Harris County. When you go to jury duty, you get a free cup of coffee.
Wait, let me stop you a second there. Wouldn't you think that if you're a jury, you want to stay awake, right? And some of those proceedings can be boring. So, I mean, you want to have some coffee. Good job.
That's right. And we required you to be there by 8 o'clock in the morning. And if you live in Kingwood or Tomball or Pasadena, you have to leave pretty early to make sure you get parked and get inside and get seated before 8 o'clock. And I don't know about you, but I need that cup of morning to get me going. So that's something that was just something small that we should have been doing all along. And that now we are doing. The other big piece of it was that we never have paid jurors for their parking downtown. So you got paid $6 to show up and serve, but you had to pay for your own parking while you were down there. And if you were lucky enough to get in the right parking garage, it cost you $6. But if you went to the wrong parking garage, it could cost you $25 to park for the day. So now we do have, on a first come, first serve basis, free parking for our jurors if you go to the right parking garage. And so we are in the process of painting that garage with an orange border around it so that we could tell you in your summons, look for the building with the orange border, and it's more easily identifiable. So you get into the right parking garage and then you get to park for free. So that was a big change too that we're very excited about.
Now, did I see somewhere about a food voucher, or is that not implemented yet?
That has been implemented, and it's a temporary measure. Because currently, with jury assembly out at NRG Arena, which we moved out there in order to be able to socially distance 6 feet apart and keep everybody safe, you do both jury assembly and voir dire at NRG Arena. Previously, when we were downtown, you did jury assembly in the assembly plaza. Then you were moved out to go to a courtroom, and you got breaks, and you could go out in the area and get lunch or whatever during recesses. But now you have to stay in NRG until the voir dire process is completed, which may mean that you get there at 8 o'clock and you don't leave till 5 o'clock that afternoon. Yeah. So, and there are very, very limited options of getting something to eat out of NRG. And so what we did was we implemented a process where you get a meal voucher. If you're still there after 11 a.m. in the morning, we'll give you a voucher that allows you to go to the concession stands and get a sandwich, some chips, and a drink.
Now, Ms. Burgess, all of that is wonderful. You're doing a great job as the Harris County District Clerk, but people have to know about this stuff. In other words, how are people? I mean, people are used to the old system where it actually cost them. In effect, our county was taxing people to serve on the jury. And now I think what you brought forth was a sort of equity in a system that, you know, allows people, everybody to participate. But you know what? Probably there are not a lot of people that would have known about it, except that I believe you started doing some stuff about that, right?
We did. And we told Commissioner's Court that none of this is going to have any impact. Even a pay increase, if we get that approved later on, won't have any impact if people don't know about it. And so we also asked them to fund a jury awareness campaign, which they have done. And we're trying to save the bulk of that when and if we get this jury pay increase approved. But we have launched a campaign to make people aware of why it's important to serve on the jury, why it's important to show up. And we're doing PSA ads on television stations. We've got a lot of social media presence. We're at a couple of different radio stations and some print media. We're targeting it into our lowest performing zip codes. We're targeting it to our minorities that are currently underrepresented. So we're targeting the Hispanic community and the African-American community by going to places that we think that are where they will see these ads more frequently and trying to talk about why it's important for you to show up and hoping that that will have an impact and move that needle. In addition to that, we've also started our electronic pre-registration for jury duty. So when you get a summons in the mail, it tells you to go online and pre-register. And previously, you got a letter in the mail. It said, show up on this date, this time, this place, somewhere about 4 to 6 weeks in the future. And we just had to hope that you were organized enough to put it on your calendar and remember to show up. Now with this pre-registration process, when they pre-register, we get your email address, we get your cell phone number. And we're able to send you information via email when you pre-register, which is what we do. What to expect, where to go, what to bring, what not to bring. Bring a sweater because it can get cold. Wear socks because you're going to have to take your shoes off to get through security. And we can tell them where they go to park and that you will be given a free cup of coffee and that you won't have to pay for your parking if you get selected and go downtown to serve on the jury. So that information can be communicated to them. In addition to that communication, we also send them reminder notices a week prior to service. Remember, you have jury service coming up next week. And then the night before, we send both an email and a text message reminder. And what that has allowed us to do is if we see we've got more people coming in than we're going to need, we can reschedule them or cancel their service. So you don't come down for us just to say, never mind, we don't need you after all. And that's what gives jury service such a bad name is when you spend half a day because you have to get up early, you have to travel downtown, you have to get in there, you go through the process. And then somewhere around 11 o'clock in the morning, they tell you, well, we don't need you. You're free to go. And then people go back to their communities and say, don't bother to go. It's a waste of time. So if we can get those numbers significantly reduced about who's there that's not needed, I think that'll have a big impact on our appearance rates as well. And we've been able to do that. We were dismissing about 37% before. 1 month, we got it down as low as 18%. And with time, we feel like we can get it down to as low as 12%.
Now, it seems like you're already measuring the metrics of the success of how you deal with people. Now, how are you going to measure the metrics of bringing in people that weren't there before? Have you instituted any type of policies to measure that?
Yes, that pre-registration allows us to capture a lot of demographic information as well. And so we can keep up with of the people are showing up, what ethnic group are they in? What age group are they in? What education status do they have? And we're monitoring those numbers. As I said, we've been underrepresented in African-American and Hispanic communities. The Hispanic community has improved slightly with their representation rate since we've been out at NRG and started this process. African-American community has slipped even a little bit further than it was before. But we have the mechanisms in place now to track it and see how we're doing and see if these campaigns and these things do help us move the needle on that.
Now, once again, let's try to get this to the audience. I'll put that in my narrative at the end. But why is it that we want to make sure that you are successful in what you're doing as far as reaching out to the entire community to be a part of our jury system?
Criminal justice reform is a huge topic of conversation across the nation right now and also right here in Harris County. And we're seeing change, and we want you to be a part of that change. And this is a way where you as an individual can have a direct impact on the outcome of somebody's life. If you're at the jury deliberation table, you're going to be in that decision-making process of what happens to that individual. And we have statistics have shown that when we have diverse juries, they deliberate longer than a homogeneous group of people would. They challenge unfair statements. They correct inaccuracies that are made. And what that leads to is fairer outcomes. And if you want to be a voice for change in criminal justice reform, be a juror at the deliberation table.
I mean, that is, you actually said something that I was going to add to, whereas if you have a diverse jury, we can all correct each other's preconceived notions or preconceived misconceptions. And that is actually very powerful in bringing justice to us all. So, Ms. Burgess, usually I have one last question to every single interview, and that goes, what would you have liked me to ask you that for some reason, in my infinite unwisdom, I didn't?
Well, the only thing I would like to add is the diversity that we're seeking is not just in ethnicity, it's in age groups as well. In the past, our juries have been predominantly older white people. And my experience in life and what I bring to the table is vastly different than someone who's 22 years old. So it's an age thing as well. And we need to get younger people more involved. So it's not just the older people. And what we found out in this process is so many young people don't even check their mail. Everything's electronic nowadays. Right. They get all their bills electronic. And they're like, but I'm not expecting anything in the mail. I may not go to my mailbox for a month. Well, if you get a jury summons, that's how it's going to come. So it's very important that we get that message out there. Please check your mail at least once a week. Your mailing address is the only thing we have as that initial contact information. So check your mail, pre-register for jury service, and show up.
Well, you just opened another door. That was supposed to be the last question, but you opened a door. I'm sorry. You just said that for younger people, most of what you do is by mail. Are you going to try to institute something, let's say, with text messaging and email? Is that against code? Or I don't know. I'm not, you know.
Right now, our jury wheel is made up of people who have either registered to vote or have a Texas driver's license or a Texas ID. That's where we pull our pool from. And that database does not include anything gotcha. Other than a mailing address. So we have no way to reach you other than through the mail.
Harris County District Clerk Merlin Burgess, thank you so kindly for having been on Politics Done Right. I mean, that work that you are doing with the jury system is long overdue. Thank you so kindly for really making our system look like what Houston looks like.
Thank you so much for having me. And if your listeners believe in what we're doing, reach out to your county commissioner and tell them they need to approve that jury pay increase.
We have a great guest today. I haven't seen him, I think, since the Democracy Convention in Madison, Wisconsin. Anyhow, today we are honored to have Michael Levitin. He's a journalist and co-founder, editor of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. He started a report as a reporter covering the Cochabamba water war in 2000 for the English language newspaper Bolivian Times. He earned his master's degree from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and later worked as a freelance correspondent in Barcelona and Berlin covering politics, culture, and climate change. He's writing is appeared at The Atlantic, Guardian, Financial Times. So look, everywhere we have a true scholar with us today who formed a very important part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Michael Levitin, welcome to Politics Done Right. How are you doing today?
Egberto, pleasure to be here, man. Very good.
Look man, you've started from the start of the movement, as you explained in your book. I mean, when they got to Sagadi Park, you were there. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the Occupy movement?
All right. For everyone who's been meticulously following it this week, given that we're on the 10-year anniversary, I presume not everyone has been thinking about it. I sure have for many years now. It was September 17th, 10 years ago, this week, coming this Friday. I wasn't there at the very start of the movement. I came the week after it began, the second Saturday of the movement, which in fact was the Saturday when Occupy blew up, when the famous pepper spray cop nailed a couple of white women in the face with bright pepper spray, and they fell down to the ground and shrieking, and it caused a sensation. I think the fact that they were a couple of young white women protesting peacefully, somehow the nation saw this, and the video went viral. Occupy Wall Street took off. And really, the movement was born from that moment, the second Saturday of the movement. And I moved into the park like so many people. I was supposed to take a flight the next day, 2 days later, to go back to Berlin, actually, which you introduced me as having history there. I wasn't intending to stay in New York, but this the showing up there, the moment that I saw and the intensity that I sort of could immediately perceive of all of these young people getting together in a way I'd never seen protesters unite and sort of organize in a very in a much more serious way, frankly, than I'd ever seen activism in this country appear before. And I knew something quite different was happening, and I helped start this newspaper everything else followed from there. The movement.
Tell folks where they can find that. It's not a blog. It's actually a full blown paper.
Oh, the paper's long gone. It was a paper of the moment.
I'm talking about your website.
Oh, my website, michaelleviton.com. My book, Generation Occupy, just appeared yesterday through Counterpoint Press. And this story really, I think a lot of people now with the 10-year anniversary are reanalyzing or trying to remember what Occupy got wrong, why it disappeared so quickly, what was its message. What really has obsessed me and kept me in the game all these years, because I did continue to edit and write and follow the trends of the movements through Occupy.com. That was a different site. That was different from the Occupied Wall Street Journal, which once it ran out of money, we stopped printing copies. We ran about 500,000 copies of that newspaper over 6 months, over five or six editions. But this story that I've told now in the book is really looking at the impact. I'm much more interested not in what Occupy got wrong as a kind of a chaotic, colorful, disorganized, structureless, leaderless movement. You can give it all of those qualifiers and say that it could have done better, it could have done this. Yeah, it faded from view, and we know for many reasons it did. But what I really have been interested in and studying and following is the many ripples and the waves that it set off politically, in activism, in our economy, and in labor, in workers recognizing their rights and everything we've seen. I'd be glad to talk in any specifics that you want to, but that's really what I've been trying to get at, is what has this decade brought us that may not have emerged in this way? Would we have a $3.5 trillion budget bill that essentially is looking to balance out the scales and diminish inequality in profound ways and put climate, clean energy infrastructure with hundreds of billions of dollars? I mean, would we have the current moment we're in? Not that we've succeeded yet, not that we've passed any significant legislation, but would we be here without Occupy? Would Bernie Sanders have been Bernie? Would we have had AOC? Would many things, would the fight for 15 have occurred? And so many things that have sprung from it. So that's what this book is addressing.
I think what you just said is so important. Let's not concentrate on the things that we did or got wrong. Let's concentrate on the things that we actually got right. Because in the aggregate, Occupy Wall Street changed this country. It changed the progressive movement. It gave validity to so much. And, some of the issues that people talk about is the movement was so white, right? It didn't represent America. But what was so interesting about the movement is that those same white kids that got engaged are the kids that would have been elsewhere not thinking of this sort of thing that Occupy represents. So you have a part where you talk about Occupy activism. I'm going out of scope here with your book, but Occupy activism, that made a lot of people who otherwise would not have been activists, activists for the good of us all. Why don't you explain it in that context?
Second here. Doors opening in a house filled with other people. The Occupy activism, the whole notion of activism, you know, in the Atlantic article I just wrote and published this week, it leads with the activism idea. In my book, it comes later because I need to get these bigger economic and political ideas out. But I think fundamentally, I mean, there's simply, we don't have this previous decade that we've just witnessed in a sense without Occupy. My case is that Occupy remade and reinvented activism for a whole generation, that it it made protesting cool again. If you think of, you know, like the 60s and the 70s, you know, protesting went out. It wasn't cool. People became, it was older white liberals. It was people out holding signs and trying to get signatures at little, you know, miniature rallies. Or it was the anti-globalization protests and people sort of trying to spur this larger workers movement and get young people energized. And it really was beginning. But then, as we remember, the Iraq war came along and sort of pulled the rug out. It was a big protest movement and people really tried to stop it, but they weren't, alas, effective. And we went to war. And when we saw what happened in the last couple of decades of those imperial, you know, adventures overseas, catastrophic failures. So protests weren't able to stop that. What Occupy did, it's like people rediscovered their courage in a profound way, and they went right to the core of the issue. They protested an issue you're not supposed to protest. They said capitalism and the system overall is the problem. They named the systemic crisis of inequality and the corporate corruption of our politics in these issues that really, frankly, since the New Deal, since the massive protests of the 30s that forced FDR to create the New Deal, Americans weren't out in the streets protesting capitalism and the moral bankruptcy of our economic system. So what Occupy did is it spurred and it named, it pointed a finger at the 1%, which then became this sort of translatable 1%, the climate movement adopted that message. Occupiers, as you say, moved in, the young white, largely white, you know, liberal from whatever college educated class of occupiers. They transitioned and helped lead the climate, helped turn into the climate movement, which again looked at the 1%. It's the 1% fossil fuel industry and the lobbyists and the CEOs who are corrupting Washington politics and obstructing change to help save our planet. And as you said, with the whiteness, I mean, a lot of occupiers, with the conversations I had with people, they made a correction in the post-Occupy era. They joined Black Lives Matter. They saw where this racial analysis, racial justice was missing. And I think you and I talked about that several years ago as I was interviewing people for the book. And you are all full credit disclosure, Egberto, you have lines in the book, and I'm glad you got your piece in there because it was a really important point that it was missing the racial justice analysis. It was a really economic justice, but really wasn't talking to the 99% because people of color largely weren't participating and didn't see themselves in the movement. But it evolved, and Black Lives Matter took so much that Occupy help generate in terms of the use of technology, how to spread viral memes, how to do a decentralized nationwide social movement that could catch fire instantly overnight with the same young generation. Of course, different issues and different priorities and different structure and leader. You know, they had actual spokespeople, actual people who helped steer the message at Black Lives Matter. They made many corrections, having studied from what Occupy got wrong. They consciously said, we're not going to be this structureless, leaderless thing. We're going to do it this way to get this concrete message across about police violence. But from Black Lives Matter, you see it all the way through. Standing Rock, the fight to, you know, defeat the water, the pipeline that was going to go through the Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Massive protest using so many tactics of Occupy. And you see it in the wave of social movements, the Me Too movement, Would we have been able to take down the giant moguls, the white 1% who are, you know, abusing their power, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world? You know, would we have been able really to kind of shatter that wall had Occupy not sort of delegitimized the 1%? And it goes on and on to the Women's March, the way it was decentralized and organized to rise up against Trump and initiate the resistance. Indivisible, the really vocal, organized protests.
Yes.
You know, Occupy just gave a fire and it sort of lit the nation, this generation that's had enough. The climate generation, the March for Our Lives, the students in Parkland who initiated the March for Our Lives, and millions of people marched to end gun violence. And guess what? The NRA is seeing its last powerful days. Those guys, since the Parkland students sort of hit the hammer against that, you know, shattered their impenetrable wall, NRA is not and is not likely to ever be the same. And in terms of its influence on our government. So we see these impacts. And when Occupy, people say Occupy was a failure.
Oh, no.
Left. All you have to do is look at where we are today as a culture, our politics of resistance and protest. And you see that, yes, it initiated this new era.
Let me tell you, I've been to several of the Occupies, from Occupies, D.C., Washington, D.C., Providence, San Diego, Houston, King, everywhere. And what you saw in that, in there, is that people finally, I mean, I don't want to make this a generational issue, but for a long time under Reaganomics, the baby boom generation kind of got complacent. And they allowed him to do quite a bit. And that Occupy generation came about and said, no mas. I don't know if you remember Roberto Mano de Piedra Durán from Panama, that boxer, they used to call him the hands of stone. When he was fighting with Leonard, he said, no more, no more, no mas. And it was like the Occupy generation said, it's going to be no more. And what Occupy, in my humble opinion, started, and I think you've articulated perfectly in your book. And folks, you got to get that book, Generation Occupy, Reawaken America. We can reawaken in America democracy by Michael Levitin. And it's not that he has several quotes of that I have in that book. Why I'm telling you to buy it, folks. I'm telling you to get this book because this is not only a refresher of all that we did in the Occupy movement in the early 2010s, this is actually a primer of what needs to continue. So check that book out, Generation Occupy, Reawakening America, American Democracy. I love the way that you split the book up. I love the way that you did it. I think it's important because in your, and folks, look at the table of contents. Occupy generation, what it is. Occupy economy. Occupy politics. Occupy climate. Occupy labor. Occupy activism, technology, world, future. Something that we all have to do if we are going to remake America, that America that works for us all. And you encompassed all of that in the description of what occurred after 10 years and made it clear. No, Occupy was not a failure. Occupy was the seedling. Go ahead.
Was that a question?
Yeah, I wanted you to expand on that because you did such a great job in the book that, yeah. I mean, like you stated very at first, we're not going to talk about all the things Occupy got wrong. Sure. Damn it. Everybody gets every movement. There are wrong things in it.
So many people, you know, the great activist who died in this last year, as I was putting the book,
CeCe,
Kevin Zeese.
Yes, that's my buddy. Yeah.
Yeah. What wonderful man and an incredible life force to the left movement.
Both he and his wife. Yeah.
And Margaret Flowers, of course. I'm sure many people who watch your show are familiar with them and their group Popular Resistance. But something Kevin told me, I had you call it luck or whatever. I got to speak with him really in depth in an interview for this book, along with other, you know, 50 other people I interviewed or so. But what he said was really a lasting message, and some other people echoed him, which is that social movements they rarely succeed overnight. Did the civil rights movement succeed?
No, we're still working on it.
You work on it. And this idea that really you don't even begin to see lasting changes from a movement, maybe for a decade, maybe for a generation, the way that Zeiss and other people have talked about, you know, you don't get to see real changes from a movement, maybe for 30 years or 40, when you really see the structural, look at this budget bill. If Congress and the Democrats and you know, if the progressive voice wins and the Bernie movement can put, you know, what Bernie started, he has been shepherding this bill through Congress, but it's like, if they can do this and we can get that agenda pushed through and turned into law, that will look a lot more like an actual win for something like Occupy. Not that you can credit it, not that Occupy.
I beg to differ. I do credit Occupy. I think when I talk about, like I said, both of us, we were all over the country when in the different from when it transitioned to places and that, like Democracy for America, or Democracy for America. What was it in Madison, Democracy,
the Madison
Democracy Convention, where all of us got together. And I mean, the thing about it is, absent Occupy, the impetus to do the things that all these other organizations feel they can do now would not have been there.
And yes, and the people now who are driving, I think the big thing that, if you want, you know, some people say, well, give me some concrete, give me, what did Occupy really do? If you say Occupy changed things, okay, we got activism, we have a new generation of young people who are completely motivated and turned on to protest and to resistance, real live, this is existential, this is an issue for me, I got to go out in the streets for climate, for gun safety, for defense of democracy when it came to Trump. But if you want to talk concrete, who is essentially steering the Democratic Party in the last few years? It isn't the old Clinton Democrats.
No, it's not.
It's not the Obama Democrats. It's the Elizabeth Warrens,
exactly,
Bernie Sanders, and the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
exactly,
and her whole train of Justice Democrat-aligned people who essentially are trying to rebalance the scales of inequality and give back to the people and get rid of corporate funding in elections, or at least run campaigns that don't rely. I mean, it transformed our politics. It gave Bernie Sanders, as many people told me, I think you probably did in our interview too, we wouldn't have had Bernie Sanders, the all-popular, meteoric, take-over-the-airwaves candidate of 2015 in the primaries in 2016, had Occupy not laid the ground and given us this inequality message, the billionaire class. You think America was ready to hear an old social democratic socialist from Vermont rail against the billionaire class and talk about the obscene corporate greed? It was Occupy that got people prepared for that. And of course, Bernie laid the ground for AOC, and we're off to the start of a new generation of politics.
Well, look, I love this book. Why don't I ask this last question to everybody? Tell me, what would you have liked me to ask you that I didn't?
Geez, Egberto.
I do it all the time, you know?
Do it all the time. I guess, something that would be interesting about this was how to put, you said you liked how the story was put together, or how the book was put together. I think an interesting part of doing this in terms of the structure is how to tell a story. You know, Occupy told a story, right? The whole thing that Occupy got right, just to conclude on that message and that movement issue, is it was able to tell an old story that's been as old as civilization itself, right? Inequality, the pharaohs, the kings, the Mesopotamia. You go back to, you want to name your place, it's always been the mass of people under the few elites who've got the grain and who've got the gold and who've, you know, aren't distributing it fairly, right? We all know that. But to make that iconic, eternal, timeless story fresh again in the current context, to tell a narrative that punctured our otherwise totally distracted and diluted, and everybody's interests are diverse, it grabbed hold. It like took America by the throat and said, wait, you're going to listen to us because we're telling you a story that really matters. And for me to tell this story, which is so kind of complex, I think it took a combination of removing myself a bit to try to be objective and like a journalist and an observer. But I also put myself in the book because and I'm a character in it, because I feel it's important to show people that everyday people, myself included, anyone who shows up at something, you just got to show up and participate. That was sort of what got me to Occupy. Like if I'd sort of just continued my plans and gotten on a plane and left, I just wouldn't have been part of this whole movement. And the last decade would have been quite different for me. But like this idea that regular people can do, you know, irregular or ordinary people can do extraordinary things, I think is a message that even this book kind of confirms. Cause I'm a journalist, but I just showed up and put myself in there. And I hope that the way that I convey and I'm able to tell this story, you know, reaches people. And yes, like you say, for future movements, that I hope young people take this story that is a decade old, and they might have only been 10 years old, not even, you know, able to, you know, comprehend much when Occupy was going on. But today they are our leader. They are our activists. They're our college students. They're our young unemployed. They're the people who need to mobilize. And I do hope they learn from this story, from what Occupy got wrong and improve on it, and from what it did so well, because we need 2.0 right now.
Michael Levitin, a good friend of mine, journalist and the author of Generation Occupy, Reawakening American Democracy. Folks, you've got to get the book. Those of us that want to make a difference, we got to understand how it was done and how we need to go forward and do it. Michael, thank you so kindly for having been on Politics and Right.
Thank you for talking. Very good. Keep it going. Always.
Again, please remember to keep your community radio station in your minds. Keep KPFT in your minds. Talk about it. Tell your friends about it. 90.1 FM, Houston. They can listen as well at kpft.org. They can contribute to us at kpft.org. They can call us at 713-526-5738, but it's at kpft.org. Folks, we are at the end of the program. I hope you enjoyed what we had to offer. We will continue to give you fresh data, fresh programming every single week from Politics Done Right. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. And you know how I end this baby. I am what? Out!
Welcome to Politics Done Right. I am your host, Egberto Willis. This is a progressive program that will take the mystery out of politics. This is the program that will encourage you to make sure government becomes we the people. Whether you are liberal, progressive, conservative, or otherwise, you get to hear your point of view. We are an independent media outlet that, unlike mainstream media beholden to corporations, we only owe allegiance to you. Remember, you can also send me a tweet at EGBERTOWILLIES. That is at Egberto Willis. Let us engage.